Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It's a great pleasure for me to chair this lecture. I'm Richard Layard, and I'm director of the Center for Economic Performance here, which has a team in Moscow that's been working with the Russian government since 1991. So we've been a bit in the thick of it and watching some of these changes that we're going to hear about this afternoon and the new prospects that they are opening up. I think we all know that one of the most important questions facing the modern world is how will Russia relate to the rest of the world? Will we be back to the old balance of power type of relationship? Or will you see Russia more like, for example, Germany in the way that it relates to the rest of the world? And I think we also know that that is closely related to a second question, which is how will Russia relate to its neighbours, the former republics of the Soviet Union, because obviously the more difficult that relationship, probably the more difficult will be the wider relationship with the rest of the world. So these are absolutely critical questions, and there's no one better placed to give us answers than Robert Levgold. He is a professor of political science at Columbia University in New York. He's been working on Russian foreign policy for at least 20 years and constantly writing about it. And some of his writings get published by the De Gruyter Company, which is an international publishing company which has sponsored this lecture. So before Robert Levgold answers the questions, Mr. Crum, who is the president of the De Gruyter Company, will say a few words, and I'd like to say that we are very grateful to De Gruyters for sponsoring the lecture. Mr. Crum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, dear Professor Levgold, ladies and gentlemen, assembled here in the old theater. Please imagine that this old theater is literally a theater, a playhouse, and you are watching that famous scene, Prince Hamlet reading a book, being asked what he was reading, answering classically, words, words, words. Finally, in the course of the dialogue, he renders the famous verdict, though this be madness, yet there's method in it. For me, a scholarly publisher from Berlin, for me, quoting Shakespeare is not just a matter of commonplace, but there's method in it, because in the year 1821 in Berlin, one of our publishing predecessors published the German Shakespeare translation by Schlegel and Tieck, which is the authoritative German Shakespeare text till today. By mentioning this, I would like to show you that De Gruyter is one of such old scholarly publishers with a long tradition, in our case, with a tradition of 250 years. Back to the playhouse. We as theater goers know that Prince Hamlet is only seemingly terrorized by the quantity of words in his book, which only seemingly don't have any message for him. His madness is simulated. But we, leaving the theater, re-entering our modern world, musing on the disdainful words, words, words iteration, we perhaps remember that we ourselves, at least in publishing, that we ourselves are used to count the number of words in order to measure the quantity of a text, regardless of its meaning. Thinking it over, we have some reason to feel sincerely terrorized by the quantity of information coming upon us, which is too much for us to keep up with, and we have some good reason to suspect this exactly be madness. The method of this madness in the scholarly world is two-sided. The academic community produces information. That is what the academic community is there for. And there's a heavy demand on publishers to get texts published. Especially young scholars are dependent on getting their work published. Otherwise, so the saying goes, they will perish. On the other side, there is no adequate demand for this information because of lack of time on the side of the scholars to read and lack of money on the side of the librarians to buy. Imagine the whole scheme. Couldn't you feel this be madness? What can publishers do about it? They try to select wisely. They advertise, and they try to build up a reputation for their publisher's name and for their colophon. Because many scholars and many librarians go for that, trusting in the wisdom of the publisher's selection. Presenting his name and colophon and books, De Gruyter is introducing himself to you as tonight's sponsor. Quite a lot of sponsoring is done by De Gruyters involuntarily, because every time we lose money on a publication, we have sponsored a piece of scholarly information flow. The publication and the information is there, the money is gone. Tonight, we are trying our best to sponsor voluntarily and graciously. Amidst the dilemma of the printed scholarly word, we invite you to an event with an added symbolic value by going back to the very origins of the word, to the spoken word, to the word as spoken in teaching and in learning, in reciting the epos, to the winged word of the Odyssey. So we invited you to a lecture. Thanks for coming. Scouting out the circumstances for this event, we were highly honored by your invitation. And you did not only offer your hospitality, but also endowed on us part of your prestige. And we are very glad that you, Professor Legwood, accepted our invitation for tonight's lecture. By suggesting tonight's theme, you were hitting a nail on its head, as seen by Berliners, because Russian foreign policy, concerning Russian foreign policy, there was no place in the world more sensitive than Berlin. Fortunately enough, the sensitivity has gone, the interest remained in Berlin, all over the world, and I think so here and here and here. So we are looking forward to listen to your winged words.
Chairman, Dr. Crum, it's a great pleasure, indeed a very real honor to speak to an audience at the London School of Economics. This is one of the institutions in Europe and the United States that I most admire. It has been a crucial institution in my field of international affairs and the many other collateral areas for so long. And there are so many of my friends and associates in the United States and in Europe who have at some point made this a part of their academic career. And specifically in my field of Soviet and post-Soviet studies, so many important contributions that have come from the LSE, beginning with Leonard Shapiro down through the current generation, including my chairman this evening. So it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm also very flattered to be giving the initial De Gruyter lecture, because Walter De Gruyter as a publisher is one of the quality houses in Europe. So any association with them is flattering. I said I would talk about, for this occasion, I would talk about not only Russia but the other post-Soviet states and in a comparative way what developments in that part of the world may mean for Western Europe versus East Asia. I know that after last evening's events, that whatever happens in any British lecture hall is anticlimactic. But nonetheless, what happens in that part of the world is important, will continue to be extremely important. And if my chairman this evening and Dr. Crum will forgive me, I'm going to disagree with them a little bit in their assumption of how central and important and salient Russia and its neighbors continues to be in the minds of Berliners and Americans and Brits and so on. Because I think, while try as we might, we are not going to be able to do what we want to do. We want to, as much as possible, render Russia and these new post-Soviet states normal and harmless and therefore forgettable. That is certainly something that's going on powerfully in my country among politicians, in the public, and among pundits, including people in the academic world. I think it's going on in almost all of the great powers, and I don't exempt Great Britain from that accusation. But it's an odd enterprise, because this age is anything but normal. And what has happened in the former Soviet Union and is happening in Russia and the post-Soviet states and what will yet happen to them matters enormously to the way in which this tale is going to end. Just as at the end of the 18th century, following 1789, at the end of the 19th century, following 1890, the dramatic, compressed history of this last decade is already dictating the shape of the next century. Thus, the period that we're living through seems to me utterly critical and utterly unnormal, despite the fact that most of us are working very hard at pretending that it's normal. At the very heart of this drama stands the historically unprecedented transformation of societies. I think that is the central feature of this remarkable era that we live in. From Estonia in the north to South Africa in the south, from Poland in the west to China in the east, countries are undergoing an unprecedented, as I said, enormous historical transformation. And I think at the core of this universe is Russia and the post-Soviet states. I think that because for them the challenge is the greatest. In this case, I'm talking not only about that shorthand list of processes that we often discuss when pointing to Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, that process of democratization, marketization, and decolonization. I think it's even bigger than that for the post-Soviet states. It's a fourfold challenge, and I believe it's a challenge that no society has faced in modern time, by which I mean the last 300 years, and therefore none of us can really understand the scale of, the difficulty of the challenge which Russia and her neighbors, its immediate neighbors, face. The first of these is indeed the problem of moving from the netherworld of post-totalitarianism to effective, open, democratic societies. That political transition, that political transformation has been difficult for other societies that have done only that in the post-war period. On top of it, indeed, is that second challenge of going from one very different economic model of physical planning to to something which entails effective functioning markets. There are very few countries that have attempted that dual transition in our own age in Eastern Europe. But on top of that, they are in Eastern Europe, on top of that, there are two further challenges which Russia and the post-Soviet states face. The third that make up this four-faced challenge is the process of creating from a void a working and a real state. State building, in the case of Russia, the reinvention of a state. And that's as fundamental as creating a state, given its history over time as part of Imperial Russia. And fourth, as the last critical aspect of this challenge, which makes it so extraordinary, the need to create of these legal fictions known as countries, Kazakhstan or Belarus, real, genuine nation states that command the loyalties not of a single people, but in almost all of them of many different peoples. It's an enormous undertaking. And the fact that so many societies, 28 or 29, depending on how you do the count, are struggling with the first two challenges, and at least 15 with, and maybe more, depending on how you look at developments in Yugoslavia, with the full fourfold challenge, and that they have done so without major violence, or without major instability, or without large-scale bloodshed, let alone without bringing to the larger international environment, the larger international setting, revolution and war, which is what happened at the end of the 18th and the 19th century, is indeed a miracle. And for me, the miracle is even larger because as part of this process, a people in one of the great states, a superpower, the Soviet people, lost an empire. They lost a system, that is, they lost an economic and a political model, and in the end, they lost a country. And still the blood didn't flow. So indeed, a real miracle. But the question is, what if miracles are not forever? What if the miracles end? And what are the chances that the miracles will end? Because surely we're only partway through this historical process. I would answer at two levels. Will the miracles end anytime soon? At one level, my view is that it's likely to continue in the near term, looking at current trends in Russia and in the post-Soviet region, the other new states. I am not part of the hand-wringing that's going on in Russia or in the West generally over the condition of Russia on the eve of the elections and what the elections may mean in Russia, or what's going on in many of the other post-Soviet states. On the contrary, my view is, and this is not where I was a year and a half ago, I was much more concerned, much more apprehensive, that in the course of the last year, and I think into the foreseeable future, by most critical trends that I would follow, things have been favorable. Let me point to several of them. I begin on the economic front. And here, from my point of view, not only in Russia, but in a number of the other states, I believe that economies are on the mend, and they are beginning to show real progress. In the case of Russia and Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and several other states, monthly inflation rates are now down below 5%, perhaps with a new exception again of October, but up until October, whereas a year and a half, 2 years ago, they were continually teetering up towards 20% a month. And what's more, the Russians are probably now experiencing positive growth with every likelihood that next year they'll have a full year of positive growth. The Ukrainians may be a year away from actually experiencing positive growth. The investment rate in Russia is up 24% in the first 9 months. Exports are up in Russia. Same thing can be said in a number of the other post-Soviet states. It's true that at the level in which the average citizen feels economic progress or economic trends, things are not better. Real income continues to slip as it did in the first 9 months of this year in Russia, as it continues to in Ukraine or Belarus or a number of the other republics. And unemployment continues to rise within these societies. So the socio-political implications of these trends are not yet positive. But at another level, from my point of view, the trends have been and are likely to be positive, have been for the last year, likely to be so into the future. Secondly, there has been the easing of political confrontation between the key parts of government, the confrontation between executive and legislative branch that was so dramatic in the case of Russia. The confrontation, indeed the war between the presidency and the parliament, 1992 through 1993, that ended with Yeltsin blowing up the parliament in October of 93, in fact has given way to, since then, a period of peace between the executive branch and the parliament. Lesser versions of the same in other republics, and indeed in other new states and in other localities within Russia, has also eased over this period of time. I'm not suggesting by any means that the relationship between executive branch and parliament is a constructive and a smooth and a productive relationship. It's anything but that. But no longer are politicians wrestling at the edge of the abyss, as they were a year and a half ago, not only in Russia but elsewhere. Third, in terms of relations between the center and the periphery, not only in Russia but in other republics, there has been working compromises established so that the centrifugal force that one worried about in the initial years of Russian independence has eased from my point of view, and people have reached understandings over the sharing of resources and over the division of authority within the country that moves in the right direction. Fourth, although they continue to travel a bumpy road, the states within this region have, by and large, much better than earlier, been able to find ways of working through and around deeply contentious issues between and among them. I'm speaking of the states within the region. 2 years ago, I think the basic dynamic in the post-Soviet space, the post-Soviet region, was one of increased tension and toward an indifferent, even a malevolent diplomacy on the part of important states, beginning with the Russians. Today, I think the trend in almost every instance has shifted to a slow, albeit an awkward and a very incomplete process of compromise. Again, I'm not arguing that they have reached success on this score, but the trends are in the right direction. One of the key developments in that respect was the Russian decision, admittedly under some pressure from the IMF, and as a good illustration of what I'm talking about, to finance the Ukrainian gas debt or energy debt to Russia in March of 1995, which in turn made it possible for the international financial community to put together the package that they did. And fifth and finally, among these favorable trends to which I would point, the wave of conflict that spread throughout the borderlands of what was still the Soviet Union in its last years and then in the first years of independence has by and large crested or leveled off. And we don't see those conflicts, none of which has been resolved, not a single one of which has been resolved, but nonetheless we don't see them growing more dangerous. They're not growing more dangerous in the sense that they're swelling. They're not growing more dangerous in the sense that they're drawing in outside powers with an internationalization of these regional conflicts from Transnistria through Nagorno-Karabakh, Georgia, to the Tajik civil war, as a number of people feared, including myself, 2 years ago. So that's one side of the picture. And from my point of view, I would add, before turning to the other side of the picture, there's almost nothing that I see coming in Russia's dual elections to the Duma in December, and if held on schedule, the presidential elections in June, that would fundamentally alter the course of these trends, at least as I see them. But I don't have time to explain myself and justify that proposition tonight, at least not in these opening comments. As I've said, however, there is another side to the picture, and that is that beneath these current trends, deep at the heart of society, all of these societies, and underneath or at the core of their relationships, remain a number of very important deformations, a number of very significant vulnerabilities, if you will. First, these societies remain largely uninstitutionalized political systems, meaning that very few effective institutions are yet in place, and in important instances are missing entirely. Political parties, despite the name and despite the number, nearly 50 of them registered to run in these parliamentary elections, are not political parties and do not perform the essential functions that political parties perform or provide in societies where they do exist. That has all kinds of implications that we know about from other instances, historically and even contemporary, but let me reduce it simply to the proposition that uninstitutionalized systems are unpredictable environments. And often out of the unpredictability comes pathologies. The second basic vulnerability, the second deformation, is an extraordinarily warped relationship between the state and society. Here it's not as simple as the rudimentary character of civil society, the way in which we often talk about this problem in the West. It seems to me somewhat different. We have a colleague in this country, Richard Rose, who's talked about Russia, and he could have the other societies as well, though he hasn't, as hourglass societies, by which he means that in the top part of the hourglass, the elites, old and new, are battling vigorously in increasingly complex political environments, battling over power, prestige, and wealth, inventing and adjusting institutions in order to serve the purposes of their struggle. Below, however, in the bottom part of that hourglass, the mass of citizens have very little stake in the fray and very little concern over the outcome among the contenders. And instead, they are indifferent and hostile to the state itself. They rely on the social infrastructure and networks that they have among themselves to provide for security and reinforcement and their needs to safeguard their lives. And for the rest, their primary interest is keeping the state off their back and out of their lives. A basic, if you will, alienation from the state, which makes it very hard for the state to mobilize their energies or to secure their support. Third, and it's not just Russia. Third, Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Georgia have all failed to come to grips with the most elemental question. And that question is, what kind of a union will their country be? I said earlier that in terms of centrifugal forces within these societies in the last year, the trends have been positive or encouraging. But beneath the surface of this trend, the truth of the matter is that the basic issue of what kind of a union any of these countries will be has not been resolved or even significantly addressed. So what we have in Russia, in Ukraine, in Kazakhstan, in Georgia, after these recent elections, in Tajikistan, well, not even in the last series of countries, but Russia and Ukraine and Kazakhstan, we have a modus vivendi, but we don't have a compact. That issue remains unsettled, and in most cases remains basically unaddressed. Fourth, and finally, all of the hard underlying sources of tension within the region, in their international relations, remains unsettled. There is very little that has been resolved. And in this circumstance, it's more dangerous than merely unsettled problems. There is an enormous amount of flammable material in this part of the world. It begins with diasporas of upwards of 60 million people, including the 25 million Russians that live outside the native base. It includes unresolved borders. Ukraine has 7 borders, 5 of them contested. Russia has 14, 10 of them contested. Virtually everyone in that is in that category. Territorial irredenta, from Kaliningrad in the west to the northern territories between Russia and Japan, and on down through the list. Historical grudges, dependencies that create frustrations as you try to exploit resources, including oil and a number of other things. And at the core of it is what I would call the Russian question. The basic issue of what, in the long run, is going to be Russia's relationship within its own neighborhood, an issue which Russia hasn't resolved because it is ultimately a fundamental question of Russian identity, and the Russians have not begun to resolve that basic issue of identity. And as a result, none of us knows what the essential dynamic is going to be within what is now a new international subsystem. A superpower has dissolved into a new international subsystem. And it's utterly impossible at this stage, for the reasons I've just given, to predict what the nature of that subsystem will be. It is both the scale and the pervasiveness of these vulnerabilities, of these deformations, that I think creates the essential nature of the challenge of this part of the world for Western Europe, for East Asia, for the United States. The essential nature is as a region. There is a natural tendency in my country, I think there's a natural tendency in Western Europe and elsewhere, to think of it as essentially a Russian problem, with some collateral issues that are raised by Ukraine and then separately by Central Asia, maybe some other key smaller portions of the former Soviet Union, such as the Baltic. But I think that's the wrong way to think about it. I think the region is crucial to all of us because all of the vulnerabilities I've just talked about apply virtually to all of the states. It's not just a Russian matter. It is for each of the other, certainly each of the other critical states, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, whatever else you want to put into the categories. So in the most fundamental sense, given the magnitude of these still unresolved issues, enormously important things, unpredictable things, can still happen in this part of the world. From here, however, I think, beyond making that point that this part of the world matters as a region, and not merely Russia and Russia's relations with, say, Ukraine, or Russia and the Caucasus around issues of instability like Nagorno-Karabakh or Abkhazia or what have you. Beyond that, then I think things do begin to look differently for Western Europe as opposed to East Asia. And this is the reason why I offered to talk about the topic this evening. For Europe, I think this is, I say Europe in total now, for Europe I think this is the best, certainly the best chance this century and perhaps since the Congress of Vienna for a continent that is whole and at peace. And both of those propositions are very important. For this to come about, though, it's my deep conviction, I don't know of others within this room, for this to come about, Europe whole and at peace, it is crucial that the post-Soviet region, with the great power in it, Russia, be an integral part of this Europe. And as part of that, that the security of the post-Soviet region be consciously and constructively linked to security within Europe generally, including the way in which it normally gets driven these days, and that is West European security combined with Central European security. The ultimate threat to Europe, from my point of view, therefore, is not the instability that could arise within Russia or the other states or between these other states and the prospect that that would generate effects that would be exported into the outer world, first Central and Eastern Europe, and then ultimately into this part of the world. That is indeed a danger, but I don't think it's the ultimate threat. I don't think the ultimate threat is that Russia will again become a direct threat to Central Europe, though that too is not implausible and could happen at some point in the future. For me, the ultimate threat is that of a divorce. The ultimate threat, from my point of view, is isolating the post-Soviet region from the remainder of Europe and making, as a consequence, making developments in this post-Soviet space, given the magnitude of everything I've just said, the significance of everything I've said, inaccessible to West European policy, and therefore the possibility of influencing developments that indeed could be costly for Europe as a whole and for Western Europe. For East Asia, the circumstance seems to me different. The post-Soviet space is much more remote to the East Asian emerging international order, with one critical exception. And that critical exception is China. For China, what happens in Russia, what happens in Central Asia, and above all else, what happens between Russia and China over Central Asia is absolutely central, absolutely critical to Chinese security. And because it's critical to Chinese security, then indirectly, it becomes important to other East Asians, from the Korean Peninsula through Japan and farther to the south. But it is, as I say, only indirectly so. I believe, however, as an indirect influence, it's likely to be extraordinarily important in the overall and longer term development of relations in East Asia, and in a way in which most of the East Asians that think about their developing international order overlook, because there's very little attention being placed on or put to the post-Soviet region in Japan or in any of the other states with the exception of China. Japan, of course, has a stake in relations, its relationship with Russia, but my own view is that in the longer run, what happens in Russian-Japanese relations is going to be largely a function of what happens in Russia's relations with the West. That's been true in the post-war period. I think it's likely to continue to be true, and I believe that what happens in Russia's relationship with the West will be defined by what takes place in Europe on that other front that I was describing. Let me look then in a little greater detail at each of these two propositions about Western Europe in the first instance, or Europe generally, and then East Asia. And I'm going to use as a way into this discussion the specific, and at this point probably over-discussed, issue of NATO expansion. Not because I want to rehearse the pros and cons of NATO expansion, the way in which it gets discussed in political circles and to some degree in our media these days, but because I think it makes the more fundamental point, I think it helps to illustrate the more fundamental points that I was arguing at the outset, the importance of this region, what the consequences are of Western policy when they don't recognize the importance of dealing with the region in general. I also recognize, without going into the detail of it, that the issue of NATO expansion at the moment may be, if not running out of gas, then at least people are easing up on the throttle, and the issue is not likely to be quite as acute in the next year or two as some people, I think, thought even 6 months ago. But again, that's not the level at which I want to talk about NATO expansion. First, because I don't believe the issue of NATO expansion is a matter of something that's right or wrong. I've never believed that. I am a critic of the idea of NATO expansion, but not because I don't believe that security in Central Europe isn't an important matter, or that Polish security isn't extremely important and deserves an answer. It has to be addressed. It has to be dealt with in some fashion. But I don't think, as I said, it is a question of right and wrong in criticizing it. From my point of view, it's really a matter of trade-offs. Is what are we trading off in order to deal with the problem of Central European security or Polish security? And I believe, by and large, the full set of trade-offs have not been adequately weighed. And the failure to weigh the full set of trade-offs is the representation of the problem that I've been describing from the beginning of these comments, at least those about Western Europe. Beginning with the Americans, the Clinton administration, but including very much the Germans, and on both sides, both SPD and Kinkel and Ruhr and the German government have been, I think, insensitive or at least inadequately aware of the broader set of trade-offs. What it is that they're hazarding in the post-Soviet space, the region, not just the relationship with Russia, which is the way in which it gets focused. Because for me, the issue of trade-offs on the other side do not begin and end with Russia. They do not begin and end with Russia's anger over the idea of NATO expansion. For me, the first trade-off that needs to be weighed, and that's very much a part of the divorce I was talking about, the isolation of the post-Soviet space from the notion of a Europe that is whole and at peace, is the likelihood of pushing an alternative set of security problems down the road, which will come back to us in a far more dangerous and acute form. That includes the problem of Baltic security, with the inclusion of Poland, the Czech Republic, and other Visegrad group members into the NATO alliance. And it includes, particularly and viciously, the issue of Ukrainian security in the longer run. We are, I think, in pursuing the idea of NATO expansion, whatever happens to it, I speak now conceptually, in pursuing the NATO expansion idea, substituting one gray zone, one security vacuum for another one. And the one that we're substituting is likely to be far livelier and far more imminent than the one that we're worried about and that we're trying to deal with through NATO expansion. I think Europe should know better. The lesson is of Locarno. Attempting to deal with European security by solving problems fractionally, only invite further problems. We ought to know those lessons in Europe from the interwar period. The second trade-off that I think is ignored before we ever get to the Russians, before we ever get to the Russian reaction, is what it does to prejudice the Western, including West European, commitment to participation in the international affairs of the post-Soviet region. The extent to which we, in effect, are cutting ourselves off from those developments, all the more significant because, as I've said, of what might follow, given the fundamental vulnerabilities and the basic deformations that are in this powerfully important region. I don't mean to suggest that I'm a great advocate of multilateralism as a solution to security problems around the world. I'm certainly not somebody who believes that there is an immense role for the OSCE or the United Nations in the post-Soviet space, but I think there is a critical role for multilateral institutions and for the great powers on the outside, including the West Europeans, to assume responsibility. At a minimum, there's a role that I call enabling, because what we're most interested in the case of the post-Soviet space is ensuring that all of the states which are capable assume responsibility for security and stability in the area, including Ukraine or Kazakhstan, that it not be left pis-aller as a Russian responsibility, arrogated by the Russians, that there not be a Monrovsky doctrine, as the Russians like to say these days. But for that to happen, multilateral institutions have to come along and make it possible for Ukraine or for the other states to play their role. What was beginning to develop in the Minsk group over Nagorno-Karabakh is a good illustration of what I'm talking about. But rather than being a prototype, it has become essentially an exception, and largely the responsibility of the little states of Europe, Finland, and before that, Sweden. It is not a central aspect of British foreign policy, of German foreign policy, or of U.S. foreign policy, unfortunately. And through NATO expansion, we are essentially defaulting. We are essentially, while we rejected a de jure Russian sphere of influence, we are indeed creating it. This will be the consequence both of the implications of and the effects of NATO expansion. The implications, by implications I mean that the West will essentially be dealing themselves out of the game within the area. Maybe we are in any event, but we certainly will formally and clearly if NATO expansion goes forward. And we are, as the result of the effects, because the Russians, who are already ambivalent about the role of outsiders, including the undertakings of international institutions in the post-Soviet space, will lose that ambivalence. They'll lose it entirely. Given the uncertainties within this region, notwithstanding the positive trends that I talked about at the outset, the fundamental potential dangers, I think the last thing in the world that we want to do is exclude ourselves from the international politics of the post-Soviet area. But only after these first two considerations, which I again underscore, reinforces the point that I was making about the centrality of this region as a region in Western European policy and East Asian policy, only after these first two considerations do we get to the Russians. And here too, even in the Russian case, I think the trade-offs are much more complex than we've been willing to focus on in our essentially narrow-minded and ahistorical perspective on European security issues and NATO expansion. There are three that I would point to. The first of them is what I see as the synergy among policy issues now on the agenda between Russia and the West, Russia and the United States. And NATO expansion drives that synergy. Everything is connected to everything else in Russian foreign policy these days, and for the worse. You would expect it in the case of the problem of renegotiating the quotas for the CFE flanks, the Conventional Forces in Europe agreement. You would expect a link, a connection between NATO expansion and that. You would even expect a connection between that and the fate of START II ratification within the Duma. And indeed, that linkage is there and reinforced by NATO expansion. But it's there on everything else. It's there for light water nuclear reactors in the U.S.-Russian relationship. It's there when it comes to the Bosnian question. It's very hard for Western governments to do what they've been pretending to do, perhaps with their eyes half closed, which is to separate different parts of their agenda with Russia and assume that they can deal with them in isolated fashion. They're having an enormous difficulty doing it. It's reinforcing. Secondly, is the danger of the Russian response in kind. If NATO expansion takes place, or if there are significant moves in this direction, I think the Russians will respond in kind, after a fashion, ineptly, ineffectively, but in kind. Symptomatic of that, or symbolic of that, is Grachev, when there's talk of the right of NATO to forward deploy tactical nuclear weapons in the Czech Republic, or in Poland, or other conventional forces from NATO, and his response is, well, then we target the Czech Republic and we target Poland. Or else the forward deployment of Russian tactical nuclear weapons, or else the creation of some kind of shell of command and control in Belarus, which would look as though the Russians were really trying to move toward defending borders forward, all forward borders except for the Ukrainian borders, which is one of the directions in which Russian military doctrine would like to move at this point. It's not that the Russians will do this effectively. They won't. They don't have the resources. It will be very incomplete. But it will generate a reaction in the West, in the relationship with the West, that will be very counterproductive, each of these steps, and reinforce the kind of spiral that we have seen in the past and don't need to see in the future. Third, I think, as a continuation of the first two points, the synergy and the foreign policy agenda with the West, and secondly, the problem of Russian response in kind to NATO expansion, you'll begin to get a further negative effect on this broad, basic issue that remains unresolved, and I think at the core of the problem of Russian foreign policy, and that is Russia's relationship with the West, what it is to be in the longer run. The other critical issue in terms of Russian identity I referred to, and that is what Russia's role is to be, how it's to relate to the near abroad, to the other new post-Soviet regimes. And in this case, you get different levels on NATO expansion. You get different levels of response on the Russian side, excuse me. Among elites, there are all kinds of technical arguments about NATO expansion, including things like the significance of nuclear weapons being forward deployed, or in some cases what the Russians thought they'd been promised in the Soviet era in the context of German reunification and entry into the NATO alliance, and the extent to which the word given to Gorbachev at that time has been violated. For the public, that doesn't matter at all. They don't care about NATO expansion in any technical sense, in any sense of a new danger to Russia. But for the public, the extent to which they are attuned to any foreign policy issue, and that's weak these days, given their other preoccupations, it is in terms of Russia's exclusion. Russia is again being isolated by the West. Russia is again being punished. For what? Not clear. But a resource for politicians if they choose to make use of it. If you'll let me, for a moment, go into an excursion on Russian relations with the West and where I think they are at the moment, and in that context say just a bit about the potential implications of the December elections for foreign policy, because I think it's likely to be greater, if there are to be consequences, likely to be greater in the foreign policy realm than on the domestic front. The relationship between Russia and all countries of the West, including the United States, has been for now nearly 2 years a very mixed relationship. We all know that. Kozarev has pronounced the honeymoon over maybe 4 or 5 times at 6-month intervals. It's long been over, and we have a number of very serious problems in the relationship. And that's recognized by leaders on all sides. That's the way we talk about it. Also, however, many reasons for seeking to preserve as much cooperation as possible. And I think the way in which that's currently structured is as follows. I think that the Yeltsin leadership, with the Clinton administration, with the Kohl leadership, with your government, has essentially agreed that we have a mixed relationship, but that the essential disposition should be one of trying to treat it as a positive-sum game. At the outset, to agree to disagree on a whole range of issues, from light water nuclear reactor sales to Iran, to Bosnian policy, but with the proposition that we will, in giving ourselves time, seek compromises in which there can be winners on both sides. Secondly, I think an important part of the Russian reaction up to this point for all of the anger at times, the outbursts, the criticism, the rhetoric, has been essentially to play within the rules. We've had outbursts from Yeltsin and from Kozarev and certainly from the Duma all along. But generally, they've played within the rules. What do I mean by that? They don't like the sanctions on Saddam Hussein's Iraq. They think there's $9 billion at stake for them, almost certainly mistaken. But they believe they have economic interests. They would like those sanctions raised, but rather than doing it unilaterally, they have activated their diplomacy in the Middle East and gone out and attempted to get the Jordanians and others to put pressure on Saddam to comply with the sanctions regime so that will be satisfied and they can then go forward with what they want in the Iraqi relationship. Or in the case of the CFE agreement, November 17th has come and gone. They're not quite in compliance with what should have been accomplished on the CFE constraints and reductions, but the basic spirit is that they will try to work it out. They will not unilaterally abrogate the CFE agreement, see if we can't get to May and work it out. That's what I mean by playing within the rules. But it's entirely possible in the December elections that the Communist Party will do better than any other organization. The number of other parties to the right, including the Congress of Russian Communities, the Skokov-Lebed group, maybe the agrarians, are going to have a far greater voice in the parliament and, more importantly, show themselves to be much stronger within the electorate at large. These are parties, beginning with the Communist Party, that are nationalistic, much more so than Brezhnev's CPSU was ever nationalistic. They are much more anti-Western in their nationalism than, ironically, Brezhnev's Communist Party of the Soviet Union was rudely and directly anti-Western. It's particularly true of Zyuganov, the leader of the Communist Party. If this dynamic between Russia and the West continues, on a foreign policy front, I think it's entirely possible within the foreseeable future that they'll stop doing what Yeltsin and Kozarev have been doing, treating this mixed relationship and its contentious issues as a positive-sum game, or hoping that it can be, and secondly, playing within the rules. What would it mean to stop playing within the rules? Not a return to the Cold War and some new kind of confrontation. It's not within their power to do that. But if they were to announce they were withdrawing from the Partnership for Peace, if they ensured that there would be no ratification of key arms control agreements, beginning with START II, but also including CTB and others, if they were to begin cozying up to or cooperating with outlaw regimes in the Third World, it would have a very significant accelerating effect in the deterioration of Russian-Western relations. From my point of view, the dynamic would be very unhappy. I think that is entirely possible. It's among what I would regard as the worst-case scenarios of the consequences of these elections. Because on a domestic front, I don't think the effect of the elections, as I said at the outset, are going to be to significantly alter the positive trends, the five positive trends that I pointed to at the beginning. Now, let me finish by turning to the Asian side of it. There is an irony for East Asia and for us in Western Europe and the United States to the problem of the relationship, because the potential for great power competition in East Asia involving the Russians would appear to be much higher than it is in Western Europe, or I should say in Europe involving the Russians, because there is the direct relationship between China and Russia over Central Asia and that very long border between the two countries. There is the secondary competition that's already underway to the south, the triangle among Russia and Turkey and Iran, focused on the Caucasus, but with the concentric circles of Central Asia and the Balkans in encompassing it. So there ought to be, as I say, much greater potential for great power competition in East Asia, in Asia, than there is in the West. It could only be Germany and Russia, but Germany and Russia over what these days, or for the foreseeable future? And yet that's not happening. The future for East Asia is not, from my point of view, going to be a dangerous great power competition between Russia and China, directly, notwithstanding the fact that they directly abut one another over critical uncertain regions. And the further part of the irony, the other side of the irony, is that so far as there is a genuine risk of alienation between Russia and other great powers, the real risk is of Russia's alienation from the Western great powers, from West Europe and from the United States, for the reasons that I was giving earlier, the isolation of the post-Soviet space and the dynamic that's underway in this other area. Instead, the Chinese and the Russians at the moment have a common stake in stability in Central Asia and along their border. They have a common stake in the stability in each other's societies, and the Chinese have made it plain that they don't particularly care what the nature of the regime is in Russia as long as it brings stability. And the Russians, for the most part, are prepared to accept Chinese developments provided it brings stability in China. And most particularly, they're not only do they in parallel seek stability in Central Asia, they're even willing to cooperate in order to get it. And as part of that process, the Chinese are, for now, and I think into the near future, prepared to defer to Russian interests in Central Asia in order to achieve it. So you do not have at present, nor do you have in the near term, from my point of view, the prospect of Chinese and Russian great power competition in Asia, which would be a significant problem for the East Asian system. But that's the current status quo. And there is no guarantee that the status quo in either of two respects will continue. There are two problems in this respect from my point of view. The first is the possibility of instability, not only in Russia or in the post-Soviet region, but also, including Central Asia, but also instability within China. And the risks of instability in two out of those three centers, Russia, Central Asia, or China, and the consequences of that for the East Asian international system, and I think for the larger international system. The alternative, and much, much farther down the road from my point of view, would indeed be the revival of Russian and Chinese competition in this part of the world, because there are a number of good logical reasons why indeed it might occur in the future. The last point I would make on this score is that behind all of this, including the risks of interacting instability or alternatively at some point down the road in the next century, the prospect of Russian-Chinese competition, great power rivalry, is a reality that we haven't had to think about for 200 or 300 years. And that reality is something I call Inner Asia. For the last 200 to 300 years, what might be seen as Inner Asia, extending from the Russian Far East down through the two Mongolias, Xinjiang in western China, Central Asia, down to Tibet, across Nepal, Afghanistan, has not been intact. It has been interrupted and in effect been stabilized by the consequences of first Russian or first Chinese and alternatively Russian imperialism within this part of the world. But that's gone. And the politics within Inner Asia is now very fluid. It has many different aspects to it, beginning with the prospects of the kind of potential uncertainty, maybe instability within Central Asia that flow from the vulnerabilities of the deformations I talked about earlier, plus some others that are peculiar to the area, including the basic question of which direction Central Asia goes. Does it go Muslim? Does it go Turkish? Does it go Asian? Even in some respects, does it go Western in the longer run? And as I say, with what issues of instability entailed. But there's also the problem of that I would call outer China, from Inner Mongolia through Xinjiang to Tibet, and the way in which that now interacts with the soft outer edges that in the past have been secure when Central Asia was a part of the Soviet Union. There are many, many illustrations. I won't go through a list, but what I have in mind are things like 8 million Uyghurs in Xinjiang, and the 200,000 to 300,000 Uyghurs in Central Asia that are the basis for a Uyghur nationalist movement, including a free Uyghuristan movement that was set up in Bishkek 2 or 3 years ago that operates radios out of Kazakhstan and that is the central focus of Li Peng's discussions with Nazarbayev when the two people get together in order to talk about Kazakh-Chinese issues and a lot of things of that kind. Well, it leads me to my concluding proposition then. I think, despite what I said at the outset, this is a lousy time for the leaderships and for the publics and for universities and research centers to be lowering their eyes in international politics. I think this is a period of utmost great power responsibility for what's happening in the outside world. And while I don't believe that the great powers, through their institutions in Europe or globally, can or will, most particularly will, assume responsibility for the post-Soviet space, I think we have an enormous interest as great powers on the outside in how others who deal with it directly manage it. We have an enormous stake in how, whether Japanese or Americans or West Europeans how the Chinese and the Russians in the long run will manage their relationship over the post-Soviet space. We have an enormous stake as West Europeans in the context of Europe in what's going to happen to European security, in how people within the region, including Ukrainians and Russians, with the help from the outside, manage these unpredictable trends given the kinds of forces I'm describing. Remember, in November 1795, or in November 1895, we were only halfway down the road. We still had Bonaparte and a lot more to come. We had not yet seen a Russo-Japanese war or even the first Moroccan crisis. There was a lot of history to come. We ought to remind ourselves of that. I'm not sure on what grounds we think we can simply insinuate ourselves through this remarkable period of history. And it's not clear that the normal, small-minded preoccupations of national leaders, so characteristic these days, will suffice. I'm not sure that it's clear that it will suffice any more than it did on the two prior occasions. Thank you very much.
Well, I think that this has been a very important lecture. It's been wonderfully clear, but more important, it's been absolutely right. And if only more people were aware of just what is going on and just what is at stake in this current situation of melting pot, I think the future of the world would be probably better. So I hope very much myself that people will read this lecture when it gets written up, and that this word will be spread by everybody who's had the privilege of listening to it. Now, that's my point of view. Let's hear some other points of view. We've got little time for some questions. Who would like to start off?
As I said, that's my worst-case analysis for the elections. I'm not saying it will happen. There are reasons why it may not happen. They include, first of all, the possibility that these groups will not be able to agree even on foreign policy because they're not going to be able to agree on many of the domestic issues. Secondly, it's not clear that even if they have, say, 45 to 50% of the Duma, and they do act together on foreign policy, that they will be able to force the hand of a Yeltsin executive if it continues. There may be ways by which the Duma, given the setup of constitutional powers, can be finessed or can be ignored. Although my view is that if they end up controlling 45, 50, 55% of the voices in the Duma, and they are united on foreign policy issues, that will have an indirect influence which will be quite powerful. Yeltsin is already reading the handwriting on the wall even before the electoral results are in, already beginning to move in that direction. It's possible that after the elections he would make Lebed Minister of Defense or Skolkov his Prime Minister, whatever, as he begins calculating the moves toward the June elections. Even then, though, even if you begin to see these effects, two things. One, there's an irony. Because if I'm right about the other trends, the risk is that in the near term you will have a further deterioration in Russian-Western relations. There's always been, already been an enormous deterioration in relations in a way that I don't think we recognize. I know in my country, if I talk to Strobe Talbot or others in the administration, they tend to put a rather good face on where things are right now, despite all of the difficulties. I'll come back to some instances of it in a moment. But I think even if those relations continue to deteriorate or are accelerated, the irony is that it's happening at a time when many of these critical things that affect stability in Russia, at least the current trends, are favorable. So how ironic that when things begin to get better in Russia, they may in fact get worse in Russian-Western relations. The second point I would make is that with that in mind, the last thing we want to do is continue to deal with this region in an unthinking way. The last thing we want to do is inadequately weigh the trade-offs from NATO expansion, because that process is simply going to accentuate what I've talked about before and accelerate the dynamic if they begin to behave that way. What we need in both cases, we see a little bit of it, but these are very weak voices shouting into hurricanes. On the Russian side, people who will write that we ought not to deal with NATO expansion in worst-case fashion. There are some very talented people, a handful of them, who are making this argument. A woman named Irina Kabrinskaya had a very sensible piece in Svodnya about 3 weeks ago. Dmitry Trenin is doing it. The security correspondent for Izvestia is doing it. And essentially, their argument is, don't make it into a worst-case analysis. True, the Brussels study paper said that NATO has the right to deploy tactical nuclear weapons in the Czech Republic and in Poland. But if we assume that's what's going to happen and act on it, then we will create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Instead, what we ought to think about is the French option, in the fact, or the Norwegian option. There are various ways in which states cooperate and are part of a NATO alliance, which doesn't have to move in that direction. And they give several other illustrations of the same. But they are such fragile, unheard voices right now, even within the elite establishment, that it's very ineffective. And the same thing is true, by and large, in the West. There are very few people that are making a broad argument about what this means in terms of the post-Soviet space. We've got a lot of people shouting at one another, at least in my country, about what it means in terms of U.S.-Russian relations. I think that's the wrong way to think about it, because of what I earlier called the divorce. On the specific illustrations of how things are getting much worse, it comes all the time in homely fashion. I was at a session the other evening with John Deutsch, who is our new director of the CIA. My question to him is, what's the state of cooperation between you and Primakov, the head of their foreign intelligence service these days? Because when Russia became independent, his predecessor, James Woolsey, and Woolsey's predecessor in the Bush administration were very enthusiastic about how these intelligence services would work together and deal with drugs and organized crime. They have a massive organization that can be useful, a lot of talk about it. We've had our FBI director over there free helping them with organized crime. Deutsch looked at me and coldly said, I have not had any contact with Primakov. We are doing absolutely nothing. Now, whether that's because the Americans don't want it, or more likely because the Russians don't want it, I don't know. But that is a specific illustration of something which is going on in much more profound terms across the relationship right now. And it's happening in the West European relationship as well. So the last thing we want to do is overreact to the elections, because in other respects, I don't think they spell a fundamental difference. It may not come out about at all, but the final thing is to say that in this respect on foreign policy, the arrival of communists back closer to power is not likely to be the same as you get, let us say, this last weekend in Poland, where Krasniewski says, I'm as committed as Wałęsa to NATO expansion. That's not likely to be a parallel in the Russian case.
Crisis period where a regime has been delegitimated. might be a relevant factor, because I can't think of historical parallels in which regimes have been able to carry out an active and at the same time aggressive foreign policy without some kind of broad social support in terms of legitimacy from the masses. And it seems to me that that kind of rash action by an elite can only happen in the immediate aftermath of a revolutionary period, which we've now perhaps overcome.
That's a subtle and a good point. I think it applies less to the capacity of elites, political leaderships, and specialized groups that have a stake in a more aggressive foreign policy, militarist, protectionist, nationalistic, to mobilize the public than it does on the issue of stability within the society. Because as I've said, what I implied when I said that uninstitutionalized systems are unpredictable in their pathologies, the pathology had primarily to do with instability, but then also with aggressive foreign policies. One partial, not by any means a perfect, but one partial parallel for the point about weakly institutionalized systems in transition that have some of this hourglass character to the society is Wilhelmine Germany in the 1890s. As I say, it's not a perfect parallel, but it suggests by any means. But it's because I'm not talking about Russia as being parallel to Wilhelmine Germany today. But the basic concepts that I'm discussing about weakly institutionalized systems or societies whose institutionalization is very warped, with this the lower effect for society, but still able to engage in a destabilizing Weltpolitik is that case. But as from my point of view, you note I'm not arguing that the outcome of either the first two propositions, uninstitutionalized political system, it's not just Russia, it's Ukraine, it's Kazakhstan, it's the others, and this misshapen relationship between state and society, not just Russia, but Ukraine and Kazakhstan and the others, necessarily will produce either an aggressive foreign policy or necessarily will produce instability. What it does do is create unpredictability in which any of these things can happen, from my point of view. So I'm not predicting it, but I'm saying that any of these things can happen. The point you make, however, is a perfectly subtle retort. Well, when you first began talking about tribes and nationalism, I thought you were going to focus the problem on the East, because that's normally where we think about the problem of tribes, ethnicity, and nationalism, and see it as surmounted in the modern international relations of Western Europe and the United States. I don't think the problem of defense expenditure in the U.S. or in Western Europe is essentially a function of that. As a matter of fact, in the United States, the problem of defense spending is essentially in Professor Layard's area, which is economic and socio. It's not in my area of security. By and large, the reason why the United States is having a lot of difficulty getting its defense budget down to something that approximates our real security interests is because of our economic stake in that defense spending. And it's very hard for legislators to give up on military construction facilities, ports, and other things within their districts. We see that all the time. I think the problem in the United States, it would be cheeky of me to suggest I knew in detail Britain or Germany or other West European countries, although I suspect what I'm about to say is true, for reasons that are not clear to me, but has the historical parallels in the 1790s and the 1890s, national leadership, and not they alone, but the informed public and their institutions in my country, Council on Foreign Relations or Brookings or our universities, mine and the others, by and large, for one reason or another, cannot convince themselves that this is a historic period. That's what's happened in other times like this. We want to pretend that it's normal. The Americans have just had an election or had an election now near, I shouldn't say just, nearly 4 years ago, in which they wanted to pretend, and they elected a man who pretended, that now most of the international responsibilities had passed and we could attend to revising a healthcare system and reviving a competitive America and dealing with a welfare system that was out of whack, and certainly not sending anybody to Somalia, not after four soldiers got dragged through the streets, or Haiti in terms of the American commitment, let alone something like Bosnia or the former Soviet Union. We're just not in a mood to make a commitment to the outside world. As a result, this is a function of a general problem of the United States not knowing what its agenda is or what our interests are in international politics. And I would venture that the same thing is going on in Europe. The same thing is certainly going on in Japan, where I frequently go. They are defining their political agenda in the most normal and narrow-minded terms. It is as if they believe that they live in the age of Christian Herder. Or Dean Rusk. But these are not the years of Christian Herder and Dean Rusk. They're extraordinary. And I don't know what accounts for that, why we are not able to, as elites, as educated, as publics, as media, as politicians, as national leaders, to arise to our own age. But it's going on across the great powers. And it's not the first time. It happened the other two times as well.
Well, thank you very, very much. These are absolutely huge issues. I think this is a very important time in world history in which, more than many other times, the choice of direction depends very much on what we do now, the choice of direction which we follow for the next 50 years. And I think we've had a wonderful introduction to these issues this evening. And we would like to thank Robert Lepgold very much indeed.